Hey everyone, I'm Janet B. I've recovered from compulsive eating and bulimia. As always, super excited to be here and now doubly excited to finish up this chapter. For those of you who were here Thursday, we did 17 things that Bill Wilson tried that didn't work, which to me, I always like talking about, but then God stepped in, launched a search and rescue mission. And here's the happily ever after. So tonight, Bill gets his happily ever after, and it can help us find ours. So if you have your big book, we are on page 8. And I'm on the paragraph that starts with trembling. So here's Bill. He just gets out of the hospital broken. He's afraid, but then he gets drunk again. And so now he says, everyone was resigned to the certainty that I would have to be shut up somewhere or would stumble along to a miserable end. How dark it is before the dawn. The dawn's coming, and this is how he describes it. He's giving us a preview of what his life is like in recovery. I was soon to be catapulted. Notice that he didn't catapult himself. He's passive. He's acted upon by a loving God. I was soon to be catapulted into what I like to call the fourth dimension of existence. You know, it's like, again, we talked about this last week. It's like you go through the wardrobe in old London and you're in Narnia. You're in a different existence. You know, Dorothy goes to black and white and suddenly she's in Oz and everything's in color, a different existence. That's what we get, a fourth dimension. And what's the fourth dimension like? He says, I was to know happiness, peace, and usefulness in a way of life that is incredibly more wonderful as time passes. One paragraph ago, he was in loneliness, despair, and self-pity. Now he's in happiness, peace, and usefulness. And notice a couple things in a way of life. That's just his normal way of life. That's more wonderful as time passes. Just like we say the illness is progressive, recovery is progressive. Okay, and we haven't even gotten to him recovering. That's just Bill's preview. So there he is. He says it's a bleak November. And maybe for some of us, it's a bleak November. And so because this miracle happened to Bill in a bleak November, maybe it can happen here. And there he is, he's drinking and he's planning on more drinking. He's got booze hidden in his house. I think this is interesting because then when Ebby came to see him, Ebby didn't say, yo, Bill, you've been drinking. You don't have 48 hours clean. I'm not talking to you. Bill didn't even have the intention to stop drinking. But Ebby was sent there, clearly God's search and rescue mission for Bill, because Ebby had recently recovered and was now God's agent, which is what we become when we do our third step. And Ebby calls him. Now, Bill's living in New York. Ebby doesn't live in New York, but he's there to visit. Again, God decided that Ebby was going to be instrumental in his search and rescue mission for Bill. So there's Bill, opens the door, and he says, there's something different. He was inexplicably different. He says, I wondered what had got into the fellow. He wasn't himself. It's like, it's Ebby, but not Ebby. And I think maybe it's something if a caterpillar has another friend who's a caterpillar, and then caterpillar A goes into a cocoon and a few months later comes out a butterfly, caterpillar B is going to say, yeah, he looks vaguely familiar, something in his eyes, but he's just not the same. And that is what happens with us when we go through this transformation. We are not the same people that we were when we started. So he says, okay, what's all this about? And Ebby says to him, I've got religion. And I looked up the definition of the word religion today, because you know sometimes it makes us bristle. But the definition is simply this: the belief in and worship of a superhuman controlling power, especially a personal God. The belief in and worship of. So not just enough to believe, right? I can believe in insulin, but if I don't make use of it, it doesn't help me. If I don't worship God, as in surrender my life to God, does me no good. And how is it described? A superhuman controlling power, not controlling as in a mean taskmaster, but someone who I can give control of my life to because he loves me, especially a personal God, not some God who created the heavens and then sat back and is watching Netflix for eternity. That doesn't work. And that's not what Ebby had. So he came right out and said, I've found God. And Bill's like, okay, yeah, whatever. Let him rant and rave. Very important. Ebby did no ranting. So it doesn't do us any good to rant when we're trying to help someone, like, look at you, look at how big you've gotten, or look at how insane you've become. You need to say, We just tell how God launched a search and rescue mission for us. And that's what Ebby did. He said, Bill, I was in court 2 months ago. Guys, we can, so it's November 8th, December, January. By January 8th, we can all be part of God's search and rescue mission to another person. 2 months. So there was Ebby in court, and two of his friends came in, and they asked the judge to suspend his commitment. He was ready to get locked up. And they told him of a simple religious idea, again, belief in and worship of a superhuman controlling power, especially a personal God, trusting that personal God, and a practical program of action, cleaning up our past and helping others. And he says, that was 2 months ago. And the result was self-evident. And then Bill said, bottom of page 9, he had come to pass his experience along to me if I cared to have it. He says, certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. We get interested when we're hopeless. It's no use generally trying to work with someone who isn't hopeless. Now, that being said, hopeless means different things to different people. We don't all have to lose our jobs, you know, put on a tremendous amount of weight. We can just say, life doesn't work. For me, I mean, I was about 20 some odd pounds heavier than I was now. I mean, I was throwing up constantly, but I still had a job. I had my looks. I had an apartment in New York City, but I was a walking zombie. I was hopeless. And what made it hopeless was I knew one day that I was like a train with no brakes and there was nothing I could do about it, that it wasn't going to get better tomorrow or the next day, that this, without some drastic intervention, that this was the rest of my life, hopeless. And there was Bill, interested because he was hopeless. And Ebby talked for hours. This isn't a 15-minute call and then we're done. And as we recall, when Bill later talked to Dr. Bob, the first call, the first 12-step meeting, it was hours. You know, we invest time. So there he is, and he's talking to him about God. That's it. Right from the beginning, he's talking to him about God. And, you know, Bill believed, as we talked about last week, in an impersonal God. Like, yeah, obviously something had to, you know, hang the stars, but he says, that's it. When they talked of a God personal to me, who was love, superhuman strength and direction, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut. Well, when our mind snaps shut, we know we're in trouble. And then he talks about religion. He talks about his brand of Christianity, page 11. And for a while, this was my brand of 12 steps. Third line, he says, for myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded. He saw he couldn't use religion that way. and we can't use 12 steps that way. And then he had some more concerns, which some people might say are legitimate. He's talking about wars, the burnings and chicanery. Again, I don't remember what chicanery is. Beverly used to put it in the definition bar, but I guess it's something really bad. What he'd seen in the war, and he says, judging from what I saw, the power of God was in human affairs. That means God breaking into our lives was negligible. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss, and he certainly had me. So there's Bill. He's really putting God on trial, isn't he? But he admits, you know what? It's like, God doesn't really have control of my life right now. And what does Ebby do? Does he sit there and does he say, well, you know, there was a war, but because of the war, this country ended up getting some freedom and, you know, that ended up this. And, you know, yeah, maybe there was, oh, someone put what chicanery was in here? Trickery. Maybe there was trickery, but it ended up good because now this country got some more land. He didn't do any of that. All he said was, you know, Bill said, the devil has me. And Ebby basically says, God has me. When I gave my life to God, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. He didn't debate. He just, you know, remember, Bill knew Ebby. He had seen him as pretty much a Skid Row drunk. And now he's a butterfly. And Ebby said, I don't know about war and all that other stuff, but God did this for me. After I admitted complete defeat, then, notice the order. First, we have to admit defeat. Then, he says, I've in effect been raised from the dead, taken from the scrap heap. Look at if I was an English teacher, I could probably talk about what that is. But if it's, I know it's passive something. He was raised. He was taken. He was acted upon by an outside power. And he said that power was God. And where was he taken? To a level of life better than the best he had ever known. To Narnia, to the fourth dimension. That's where he went. And he said, had this power originated in him? And it was like, no. It's not like this power is, you know, like Star Wars, the force within us waiting to be awakened. God's like understood here, a separate entity. However, when we do these steps, when we do the work, we get access to the power of God. And then whether God comes and lives inside us, that's a question for the theologians. But here was Ebby who said, there was no more power, no power in me, none at all. But something happened. And Bill saying, here was something at work in a human heart, which had done the impossible, impossible. And he said, my ideas about miracles were drastically revised. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. Right, what good would it do if Ebby said, you know, you should believe in God because like God parted the Red Sea when, you know, Moses did that whole let my people go and led the Israelites out of Egypt. Bill might say, yeah, that might be a miracle, but that was in the past. Bill's like, forget about the musty past, a miracle across my kitchen table. That's what we're supposed to be to each other, miracles in the flesh. And he says, he shouted great tidings. Great tidings, all it means is good news. He shouted good news. And he said, my friend was more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped a new soil. He had a root transplant, right? Different. He was in the garden of self and he was transplanted to the garden of God, to the garden of caring about others. And Bill's like, well, still, you know, prejudice against God, trying to work through it. And Ebby says to him, why don't you choose your own conception of God? And that did it. That did it for Bill. He didn't have to choose another conception. And he said, It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. Step one isn't a beginning, right? If I admit I'm powerless over diabetes and my life is unmanageable, you're not going to expect me to get better. But if I become willing to believe that insulin can restore my pancreas to health, okay, I'm on the right track when I inject the insulin. And that's what our third step is, right? When we just make a decision to turn our will and our lives over to God. But there's a difference between believing in insulin and believing in God, because belief in God actually causes something to happen. We don't know exactly how, because this is on a spiritual plane, but think about it. No one needs to believe that insulin can restore them to health. If there's a baby who has diabetes and their mother injects them with insulin, they're going to get better. The baby doesn't have to believe that insulin can help them. But think about our step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We have to believe that God can help us. Why? Because in the spiritual plane, faith actually causes things to happen. We don't hand God a $20 bill. That's the currency in the physical world. In the spiritual world, it's faith, generally activated by prayer, that causes things to happen. So when we begin to believe that God can restore us to sanity, it actually sets in motion for God to start restoring us to sanity. And he said, upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. So we build it through the steps. And he says, okay, I was convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough to do the work. Look at what Bill says. It's so pretty. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed. Scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. So his willingness to connect with God caused the scales of pride and prejudice to fall from the eyes. I would say the eyes of his heart. And what is pride and what is prejudice? I think pride is when we think of ourselves too much and think too much of ourselves. And prejudice is when we think too little of others and or think of others too little. Okay. And that fell away from Bill, just fell away. And he said, you know, I once had an experience of God before. I was willing, I was humble, and he came, but it was blotted out by worldly clamors. So if you want to know how to blot God, worldly clamors, it's described on page 55. The things that block us from God: pomp, circumstances, and worship of other things. Those are things that will just create those spiritual cataracts so we can't see God. And what does he say? Those worldly clamors had me, and how blind I had been. They stop us from seeing God. So, and he says he went to the hospital, and he gives his reason. Otherwise, I would have gone through delirium tremens. That's it. That he wouldn't go through a physical withdrawal that caused acute pain. But again, Ebby didn't say to him, I'm taking you to the hospital, see you in 48 hours. In fact, he worked with him in the hospital. It says, my schoolmate visited me. And what did Bill do in the hospital? Page 13, I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him, because our concept of God grows the more we work this program. And what does he say to God? Do with me whatever you want. And he placed himself under God's care, trusting that God would take care of him, and direction, trusting that God would guide him. And he says, I admitted for the first time of myself, I was nothing. Without God, I was lost. And then he says, I ruthlessly faced my sins. You know, back then they called them sins in the Oxford group where he recovered. Now we call them defects. And I like that. He was hard on himself. He was ruthless on himself. You know, being hard on ourselves has gotten a bad rap these days. You know, people are told, oh, you're too hard on yourself. Be easy. Take, you know, you have to be gentle, self-care, all this stuff. No, the book says we are hard on ourselves, but considerate of others. So we're not hard on ourselves in the fact of like, oh, Janet, you're a terrible person. Look at what you did. But I look at what I did with a ruthless eye, because the mechanism God has established for getting rid of our defects is that we have to see them and admit them. Now, of course, God sees them. He doesn't need me to admit them to know they're there. But that's the mechanism, right? We admit it. You know, we admit it, we go through on our fifth step, we admit it, and then we ask God to remove them. We are ruthless with ourselves. And that was the end of his drinking. So his friend Ebby visited him. It looks like he did his inventory, talked about making his amends. And again, he says, never was I to be critical of them. Remember, hard on ourselves, considerate of others. And then he gets the results of surrendering to God. Common sense becomes uncommon sense, not as a result of going to meetings, you know, as a result of surrendering. And it gives us a formula, what to do, how to handle doubt. He says, I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking. Whenever we see the word asking, referring to God, it means praying, only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. So how often do we do that? How often do I do that when there's doubt, to just say, God, please give me the strength and the direction to meet my problems you would have me, and then to sit quietly. That's a formula we're given for how to handle doubt. And Ebby promises when Bill works through these steps, he would enter upon a new relationship with his creator. Guys, that's the goal of this book, to show us how to have a relationship with our creator, where we can access his power and become his agents for the good he wants to do in this world. And not only that, if that's all we got, that would be enough. But we get the elements of a way of living to answer all of our problems, all of our problems. And what's required to make a beginning? Belief in the power of God, willingness, honesty, and humility. Well, we all know about honesty, right? That if we're dishonest, it's like we took a big black magic marker and wrote the words, keep out God, right over our hearts, because God and dishonesty can't coexist. So Bill's, we're on page 14 now, and he's saying, simple, right? If we hear it talked about, it's simple. He says, yeah, but it's not easy. And a price had to be paid. The destruction of self-centeredness, right? On page 62, our book tells us selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of the illness. We can't just get rid of the symptoms, right? The fear, the resentments, the harms to others, those are symptoms. Yeah, we'll need to clean that up. But we need to get this up by the roots. We need to stop being selfish and self-centered. And how do we do it? Turn in all things to the Father of light who presides over us all. So if God is helping me and loves me, I have to think that he's helping and loving everyone else as well. And I heard someone say, a former sponsor of mine said, if you think about the person you resent the most, God's really loving on that person, because that person needs to be protected from your resentment. He's the Father of light for all of us, even the person in my life who I might dislike the most. So Bill says, okay, these are revolutionary and drastic proposals. This is like, you know, revolution, right? Like a war, crazy stuff. He says, but as soon as he accepted it, he had an instant spiritual experience. Most of us have a spiritual awakening. It's like gradual, right? You know, you plant a flower, you don't see it, you know, with Bill, it was like planted a seed and the next day he's got a 10-foot rose bush. That's not how it happens with most of us. With most of us, we see the growth very slowly, which is okay as long as we're seeing growth, even if it's slow. And we're very fortunate because this book lays out with each step, starting with step two, not every step, but most of them, step two, three, four, five, seven, nine, 10, promises the growth we should be seeing. So if we're not sure how we're doing, we can always check ourselves out against the promises and see if we're experiencing them. Again, it says they come sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but always, always to those who work for them. So there's Bill, and he's kind of afraid. He uses the word alarmed, and he calls a doctor to say, okay, am I sane? So often, if we take a big spiritual step forward, the illness is not going to say, oh, Janet just took this big spiritual leap forward. I'm going to be really happy for her. The illness is going to try to get me to take two steps back. And what are the illness's tools? Fear and doubt. Fear, oh my gosh, you know, like what's my future going to be? And doubt. Could this really be real? And what do we do? Well, this is what I was told to do. I was told to just talk right to the illness and to say, illness, I've listened to you all my life. And all you've ever gotten me was, you know, binging and purging and misery. So I'm not going to listen to you anymore. I've thrown in my lot with God now. So you can use your same old tricks, fear and doubt. I'm not listening. So just be gone before someone drops the house on you. And then we turn to God. Oh yeah, we laugh. You know, the illness doesn't like to be laughed at. We can laugh, we can have fun. And then we turn to God and we pray. God, I just told the illness to take a hike. And I know that the illness is stronger than me, but not stronger than you. So can you please make the illness take a hike? And then we find someone to help and go about our day. So there's Bill still in the hospital, bottom of page 14. And he says, while I lay in the hospital, the thought came again, God's already starting to direct his thoughts, that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They in turn might work with others. Amen to that, right? Look what happened. And then a really critical line. He says, my friend told me that it's imperative to work with others. Then he says, bottom of page 14, faith without works was dead. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic or compulsive eater. For if an alcoholic, compulsive eater failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through, now, if I wrote this book, I would say we perfect and enlarge our spiritual life through prayer, meditation, and spiritual reading. But that's not what it says. It says for us, the way to perfect and enlarge our spiritual life is through work and self-sacrifice for others. It says if we don't do that, we can't survive the certain, meaning guaranteed, trials and low spots ahead. So if we work this program, it doesn't mean that we're never going to have hard things in our lives, but it does mean we can survive them. If I've already strengthened my spiritual muscle, right? Through I can't wait till something happens. I mean, maybe, right? I mean, God does answer Hail Mary prayers, but we're supposed to build up our spiritual muscle through work and self-sacrifice for others. How do we know something's a self-sacrifice? I have to be able to name something that I'm sacrificing. Is it money? Is it time? Is it sleep? Is it something that I wanted to do in order to help another person? So we are people who have to go out looking for ways to do things that are a self-sacrifice. And none of us like it, right? If it was fun, it wouldn't be a self-sacrifice. However, the beauty of this program is the longer we work it, then the more God rewires our hearts, the more our priorities and his priorities kind of sync up. So he says, if we don't do this work, we're going to drink again and then we'll die. That's how seriously they took it. Not like, oh, I'll gain 5 pounds and won't look good for my college reunion. Like this was life or death. And then they're saying, yeah, who cares about faith then, right? If we're out binging or drinking, what good is it to say, I believe in God? So there he was, goes off helping people. And even though he was doing all this work, he says, he was still sometimes plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. And he said, when all other measures failed, so he did his inventories, work with another alcoholic would save the day. So how to deal with self-pity and resentment when inventories aren't working. And he says, on talking to a man there in the hospital, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for living that works in rough going. I mean, if I was created so that if I have pneumonia, bacterial pneumonia, penicillin is a design for health to get me better. The way that I was designed is that if I'm filled with self-pity and resentment and I've done my inventories and it still doesn't go away, I need to help another person and then it'll go away. That's how God designed me. Do other people need to do that to get rid of self-pity and resentment? I have no idea. It's not my business. That's how God designed me. So he tells us then, page 15, the joy of living we really have, even under pressure and difficulties. We can be happy even when things are hard. And he says, there's scarcely any form of trouble and misery which has not been overcome among us. That's a wonderful thing about this fellowship. It's very likely that whatever problem I may be having, you may be having, there's someone else who's had this problem and has overcome it, or is walking through it at the same time and pace that you are, and you can hold each other's hand as you walk through it. That's how Melissa and I met. We met at a meeting one day. We started talking. We both had, you know, a same problem situation in our lives. I mean, it was almost like, it was almost freaky how similar it was. And that was it. And we've, you know, pulled each other through. One day, you know, I'm pulling her. More often she's pulling me. But that's what this fellowship is about. And it says, we meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. You know, we're here for good information and fellowship and information. That's why we always like to leave time for questions at the end so newcomers can get any help that they seek. Page 16, they say we're growing in numbers and power. I don't think by power they mean power like we're going to take over the world, but that this spiritual power is like getting unleashed in the world. And he says, okay, an alcoholic in his cups, which I'm assuming means drunk, is an unlovely creature. It's okay. My job is to love them anyway. That's a measure of how well I'm doing spiritually. Can I love someone who the world would think isn't lovable? That's my goal, to be able to love the unlovable even more. And he says, yeah, it's work, but there's a vast amount of fun about it. You know, recovery should be fun. But underneath, we're serious. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us. We live our lives based on faith. And then he closes by saying, most of us feel we need look no further for utopia. And I looked up the meaning of utopia today, and it says an ideal place, an ideal place. We have it with us right here and now. And how does he close? His last line, each day, my friends, simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill to men. And aren't we so blessed and grateful to be part of that circle. And with that, I pass.